I'm Dr. Rosalind Austin, and welcome to Researcher Revealed. On today's podcast, we have joining us one of the UK's NIHR senior research nurse leaders. His name is Ola Dio, and he's going to tell us a little bit about his journey. And then, well, let's be honest, we dived down and we got really, really quite deep and philosophical about the role of systems and hierarchies and how that influences research. So I'm still, my head's spinning a bit from that conversation. Really, really inspiring. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. I'm Dr. Rosalind Austin, and on today's episode of Researcher Revealed, we have the very wonderful Ola Dio, who's joining us to tell us all about his journey into research. Ola Dio, can you introduce yourself to everyone, please?
Thank you, Rosalind. Thanks for having me here today. My name is Ola Bifine. I'm a clinical academic with a mental health nursing background. I'm also one of the NIHR senior research leaders. That's me.
Oh, very exciting. I can't wait to get into your journey to find out how you ended up as one of the very rare but very esteemed NIHR senior research leaders here in the UK. But before we do that, tradition is that it's time for the researcher rapid 11. Are you ready?
Yeah, let's go for it.
Perfect. Are you a Windows or Mac user?
Mac.
Ooh, that's two in a row now that I've had Mac. They're making a comeback. Tea or coffee?
It depends on, I'm flexible, but coffee is the preference.
Okay, nice. Very exciting. When you're writing, do you prefer to write with silence or some sort of music or sound in the background?
Silence, because it's that early morning time that I just got to get out of my head. So there's no time to think of the music, really.
Nice. I've been converting. I'm starting to work. I used to have to always write with music in the background, but I've started to now write in a lot more silence, and I think it's growing on me.
It's yeah, I mean, I think different people will just have different styles. So for me, it's always been get those thoughts in your head, get them on paper, and just write, just put the vomit on the paper. Yeah,
the vomit on the paper.
Indeed, because it takes time before it gets refined.
I love that, the vomit on the paper. Oh, that's good. That tickles my funny bone. Right, next question. Where do you tend to do your research work, at home or in an office?
It tends to be at home, because when I'm in the office, essentially, either I'm in meetings or I'm teaching. So it tends to be when I have this time to, you know, to do some admin work, and I just use that part of the time to write my research.
Fair enough. What time of day would you say you are most productive?
Between 6 and 8 in the morning.
6 and 8. Oh, you're an early bird. Nice.
I am.
I go through phases.
Yeah.
Which referencing management system is your favorite?
EndNote.
Nice. What about favorite data visualization tool? So like making your graphs, your figures, that sort of thing.
I really do them personally, but with my PhD students who use them, it tends to be Excel.
Okay. Nice. So in reality, other people, but this is the backup is Excel.
Indeed.
I love you're not alone. There's quite a lot of people who are like, yeah, other people.
Yeah.
Which I love. What about a favorite desk snack? Something that you chew on while you're working?
I actually forget to eat. I can't think of. I think it's more coffee. Drinks.
Okay.
But oftentimes when I'm just working, sometimes I forget to go for lunch.
Yeah, you just get so deep into it. But
I'm not sure that's a good thing, but that's just how I, you know, one of my colleagues will say to me, Oladayo, get up and go up and move. Yeah, sometimes you just like to get my things done, and then I know that it's boxed off because, yeah.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I definitely hear you on that one. Right. When you're planning or organizing, so whether that's like your life, whether that's like the content of a project or a paper, are you a digital organizer or are you a pen and paper?
Pen and paper. I've been introduced to one digital platform, but I don't think I've not used it. But I'm very much pen and paper. Yeah.
Yeah, me too. I love my pen and paper.
It's handy. It's handy.
Well, it's handy. And the other thing, like I find, is the reason why I love pen and paper is there's just the freedom that you don't get with a digital tool. Like you can scratch stuff out, but you can still sort of see it. You can draw things. Like it's just, you don't have to use multiple things. And there probably is a platform out there, but it just doesn't feel real to me unless it's pen and paper.
I think for me as well, when I write things down, I mentalize better. So it allows me time to allow my brain to get that this is a thing, as opposed to, typing it. And I spend a lot of time on the screen anyway, so that also takes me away from the screen. So, and it works. So if it's working, let's not break it.
I totally agree. Love it. Right, two more questions. What book are you currently reading? Now, it doesn't have to be a professional book. It can be a fun book.
So at the moment, there's one I always go to, particularly when I want to, do some writing or heavy lifting, if you like. When I'm in that particular zone, it's Deep Work,
It's
by
what?
Deep Work,
Deep Work. I haven't heard of that one.
and that's by you should read it by Carl Newport. Essentially, it's just a case of how do you stay focused in this sort of heavy, this fast-paced world we live in, particularly social media and things like that. So that's a particular book that gives you good tips in terms of how you don't sort of take the cognitive load with you and help you to free up some space in your head to do what you want to do.
Oh my word, I think I will be going straight on to Amazon to order that because that sounds like I need that book in my life.
I find it very. I mean, this is my fourth time of reading it, and there's always something new that just comes out to me, because I think in this current, the rate at which information is getting across to us, it's the speed is just it's unbelievable. So it's a case of how do you sort of compartmentalize? How do you ensure that those things are not even cognitively, taking away your focus? It's really good. I recommend it for anyone who has interest in things like that.
If you're out there and listening and you're not sure how to find the book, if you go into the description of this episode, in addition to lots of other details, I will list the title and author of this book that is highly recommended by Oladio. So if you're interested, you can find it on Amazon, order it however you want, whether it's e or paper or whatever. So yeah, check out the description below. Last question is, who is a researcher who you admire?
That's a tricky one for me. And I can give you different names. I think it depends on when you ask me the question, but now you're asking the question today. I think the one that comes to mind will be my primary PhD supervisor, Professor Jana Yobode, for she's at the University of Bradford. And for me, she was a doer. So for some, when I use the word doer, you send manuscripts to people and they just keep giving you comments and comments and comments and comments. If we are collaborating on this particular work, put your ideas on those papers. Don't just give me comment. So Professor Janabody actually has allowed me to be able to support other people. Because when I was doing my PhD, for someone who has gone for, traditional nursing program where research is not really well, I wouldn't say not it's not well taught, but people are teaching according to the curriculum, but the fact is, people leave university and sometimes they don't want to come back because, you know, that particular module, it's not always well received, is the word I'm looking for here. So it was jumping to a PhD and having the primary supervisor who was able to demonstrate, you know, this is how, is this what you're saying? This is how I will give you a sense of, am I correct? Feel free to, you know, and that is my style up to date. That my PhD student, my master's student, I would show this is my thinking. You don't have to agree, but I wouldn't leave them with many comments that then, you know, not give them that sense of collaboration. So to me, I do admire Professor Daniel Ibodi a lot because of that particular stage I was in my career, and how how I've taken that lesson with me up to date.
Okay, cool. Thank you. It's adding to a list of very impressive people and researchers that I'm starting to put together. So thank you for sharing that with me. That's all of the rapid 11 questions. Get to know you a little bit better. And in your answer to that last question, you've actually perfectly segued into my next question, because you've mentioned, and I mean, I know this being a nurse myself, that research and nursing, I liked your word, are not well received, but I'd go like they're not best friends. Is kind of like, to make it really, really simple, they're not best friends. And there's a bit of misunderstanding from ward nurses on what research looks like and what being a researcher or even doing like the career of helping with clinical trials as a research nurse. There's a lot of misunderstandings between ward nursing academics, so people who are primarily teaching nursing students, but then there's these people in the middle like you who are kind of starting to do bits and bobs of everything that in the UK we class as clinical academics. So, given that we've agreed that this thing called research for a nurse is kind of this not well received thing, not really that well known of, how did you end up getting interested in research?
It's my journey around trying to make sense of theoretical landscape and the practicalities in terms of reward. For example, it started with me going for my master's program, mental health nursing, and attended lectures. You get thought this is the ideal, this is what should happen. And then I went on placement. This is what is happening. They don't
And
speak
the
to
two
each
didn't
other.
match?
No, not all the time. Most of the time, it's not the case. And it was a case of, okay, what do I do with this? I turned up, and again, the way I tend to learn is I write, and that's because I'm trying to learn. So I wouldn't even consider myself at that time as a researcher. I think this is one of the aspects that we perhaps in nurse education we're still missing. I can only talk for the UK context. That the fact that you are submitting an assignment, you are a researcher.
That's such a good way of phrasing it. I never thought of that.
And that's a trick that I think we stay away from submit an assignment. But in my own, when I was on that journey, it was a case of, I'm trying to make sense of my world, my identity as a mental health nurse. So what do I do? I had to then turn my assignment. I submitted my assignment. I got good grades, and I thought, well, if I'm getting good grades, I'm not going to just submit those assignments and forget about it on Blackboard or Canvas or whatever the platform is. I will publish this piece of work. So when I was at uni, I published a lot of my assignments. And that
So
was what you.
just put a pin in that.
Yeah.
How did you come up with that idea? Like what made you think, oh, let's publish this assignment? Because that's highly unusual thinking.
I've always wanted to be an academic because I do understand from the outset that that is your publications are your currency in academia as far as I'm concerned. So if you want your profession to have the credibility, then you've got to put the work out there. So I've
Nice.
always had that mindset anyway.
Okay.
But that was not in on my mind when I was going through my training. I just want to survive. I just want to make sense of what I'm trying to do. How do I socialize into the profession and have the
Yeah.
credibility that is
Yeah.
needed
Yeah.
for someone like myself? So that was all I was doing.
Yeah.
But I must give credit to the person that marked my first assignment, Dr. David Stonehouse, who gave me very good feedback. And again, that's the point about having people that can talent spot, if you like.
Yeah.
And it was a case of this is good. You should publish this. And that was a language. And I just gave you a go. And that was it.
Wow. I really like that. I think so. I'm just scratching that down because I liked how you said that is, the importance of people along your journey as a nurse through nursing education who can. And you use the term talent spot, and it's spot, and it's much more of a business term, but I think it applies within nursing as well. Because, like, if we are going to achieve the goals that NHS England and NIHR have set out for nursing, those of us who are now being labelled as clinical academics, as nurse researchers, as nurse academics, the only way we're going to grow the percentage of people who venture down this pathway are by doing exactly what you're saying, is identifying those people and being like, hey, this is good work, and this is something that should be celebrated. And again, like, I'm sure you've read it, but there's quite a culture in nursing. The phrase in so I was trained in North America, and the phrase in North America is nurses eating their young. So there's a bit of a culture of those established nurses, instead of being those talent spotters, being like, hey, let's lift you up, let's rise, let's encourage. It's much more and pushing people down. And so I think that's a really important point to raise from your journey, is that those indiv yes, you had your own individual fire, but you also had people who came across to help lift you up.
Absolutely, and that thing about nurses or nursing as a profession eating their young is one that we need to still work on collectively, because I would argue that it's convenient to micromanage people, because you're going to manage the people might argue that I'm not micromanaging, I'm just doing my job. But when you see that there's a potential here, even if it's a bad work, but they've got the motivation, join forces with them as opposed to giving them more work to do and then they get overwhelmed. And sometimes if you don't know, it's okay you don't know. But don't make it about that particular person. And I don't think anyone set up to make it about a particular person, if I'm being honest. But what's important is how the receiver of the message
Perceive it.
how perceive it. And that's something we still need to work on
Definitely.
as a profession. Yes.
Definitely. Anyway, sidetracked there. Back to your journey. So as you were going through your master's degree, you were writing assignments, and partly because of your own fire, but also because of the encouragement that you had, you started submitting those for publication. So how did you go from doing that and fast forward up to doing your PhD, completing your PhD, to end up where you're sitting now? Because that's quite a big jump.
The more I progressed, it was again. It is me. This is me. I like to understand why. I'm very curious, and I want to know. My journey has always been, you know, finishing at the master's program before I even got my PIN. I think I sent out and I think I sent about 14 emails to 14 different professors, in the UK, asking for opportunities to do my PhD.
Oh, wow.
Because I know that things don't happen automatically, but when you put yourself on their radar, the opportunity. And I think one person replied to me to say, this is the link, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what you get. That's a link. If you look at that link, you know. and then 2 years down the line, or a year and a half down the line, I got an email back from one of the professors, Professor Daniel Ibode, who said a particular advert for full scholarship is going out in the next 3 weeks. That's applied to that. And look at that example of someone who just, you know, sent an email and gave me more work to do, and somebody who actually wants to enable. And that is a good example of,
yeah,
if
that
you want to enable
a
people.
Beautiful example of what you're talking about, that here you go, don't bother me approach. Or like you said, I actually liked your words better, like, here you go, here's some more work, you have to sort it out, versus, hey, I saw this, I thought of you, let's work on this together, so that you, it's that collaborative approach.
It was a tangible thing to offer.
Yeah.
And it took a year and a half, so I don't think anyone expects something instantly. But it's you just thinking about how other people's work, particularly early career researchers, it's a struggle to make sense of everything. So it's supporting people, giving them more stuff to do. So for me, that's been the journey. And doing my PhD it was very obvious when I qualified that I needed to enhance my skill set.
Okay.
To be able to better articulate clinical problems.
Okay. So now, explain what you mean by enhance your skill set.
So we can find ourselves in a terrain where, I can speak for nursing in the UK, where for a second, evidence-based practice, as far as I'm concerned, has to be about the empirical evidence, your patient's preferences, and your clinical expertise.
Yeah,
those three things must intersect if you're saying this is evidence-based practice.
Yeah,
but in the context where I see patient preferences and I see what clinicians think is best for the patient, and I see what the empirical evidence is suggesting, and they don't align, then to me, that is the case of, how do I support my patient? And that's where it was important for me to sort of enhance my skill set. And that was why the pathway for me was to go for a PhD, where, you know, you get thoughts about methods and approaches.
Yeah.
And I would say that that's one of the best decisions I made in my career, because it could have been so convenient for me to stay there and complain, and, you know, but I'm not wired that way.
Yeah. That's brilliant. Don't complain. Get a PhD.
But having said that, I think it's important to say that, you know, don't complain, but, you know, find people that would potentially support you to develop the skill set you need to support yourself, your career, or to support your patient. So it's not really about the PhD, because I'm a strong advocate that when you think of research, I tell people now, when I use the word research, what I want you to think about is, how do I support research?
Yeah.
How do I deliver research? How do I lead on research?
Yeah,
three different things.
I think I believe the same. I see research as a spectrum.
Yes.
And I agree with you in that not every nurse needs to obtain a PhD. And there are 5 million ways that every nurse could contribute to research if they were surrounded by that collaborative, proactive approach. You don't need to have, you know, all of this other stuff happen in your life, but having somebody, having a resource, having somebody locally who can be like, hey, I noticed this thing when I was practicing. Can you help me figure out how we can make it better? You know, and work with that individual. And I think one of the things, so down in the South Coast, our ARC, and I'm sure other ARCs have it as well, so Applied Research Collaborative, have a lot of what they call internships. And an internship gives any clinician the opportunity to have a little taster. So they get an award that buys out a little bit of time, and they can then work with more senior individuals to work on a real problem that they're facing, to try and better understand it. And for some people, that's enough. For other people, it inspires them to master's or other stuff. But it starts that, I like the term culture of curiosity, that it builds within nursing. And I think by having a much more curious nursing culture, you'll enable people to want to do more about the things that, like you say, like that don't match. Like, you read this or you were taught this in your education, and then you go on your ward and you're like, guys. But then you talk to those ward nurses and they're like, it's always the way it is. And it can be very easy to just go, well, it's always the way it is, rather than challenging it. So I think having that more curious culture will really help with that.
100%. And when I say that as well, oftentimes it's not that one is wrong and the other is right. So when I say practice and the theoretical component, it's just that if we could just talk to us, to that, if those words could talk to themselves better and actually move away from this tokenistic approach to say, you know, I'm going to partner with this organization. What does that look like? Are you actually going to give that particular, you know, the nurse you identified to be a co-author on that paper so they can see the process from, you know, the idea conception to actually an output? And that's what I think the work that, you know, the likes of Ruth Endicott, Joe, Joe Cooper, the work they are doing in that space at the moment is great to see. Because that would, you know, give those clinicians that credibility that hasn't been given to them for a long time, if I'm being honest. And going back to the first question you asked as well, in terms of the cultural aspect, you know, nursing arguably has been this vocation, if you like. We do it because we care. It's okay to care, but what your profession is asking of you is to clearly articulate what does it look like to provide care. And that's where we need to ensure that we are enabling people to genuinely support research programs. And if they want to then take and lead on the edge, they've got to see what it looks like first before they can go forward into that. In my own case, I had the sense, I had a passion, and I just went with that. Thankfully, I had people that were able to support me along the way.
It's so encouraging to hear that journey for you, and how you've progressed, and how I can hear in your voice that passion and that fire is still there. And I have no doubt that it's infectious with the other nurses that you hear interacting with, because you're already firing me up again already.
I hope so. I hope so. If anything at all, I said to myself that I would like to be the change I want to see. It doesn't mean I would achieve all of them, but what you see when you hear of Oladayo is I'm trying my best. And I must say as well that I'm still learning. And that's the beauty of being a researcher. And again, it's a case of collaborating, bringing good heads together. You get something novel. And that is what I'm about.
I think I totally agree with you. I think that, like, if I look back at my PhD experience, I think it's going to sound like a weird thing to say, but for me, and I think I'm hearing it in what you're saying as well, one of the biggest gifts that doing my PhD has given me, and how it's changed how I see the world, is it helped me see that it's not all up to me. And actually, I will be a stronger and better researcher by recognizing where my limitations are and getting others to collaborate with me. And I'll actually be a weaker researcher if I try and do it all by myself. And I think, like, my personality and who I am, I'm like, yay!
It's a very, very, very difficult terrain to navigate. So when I have conversations and people say, so what do you want from me? I'm thinking, I've just presented something to you. What can you contribute? You know, those things, they go a long way, if I'm being honest, particularly in a discipline that, you know, that not really conversant with research. This thing shouldn't be transactional is my argument, but I get it if people want it to be transactional. But for me, it's that collaboration. It's the people.
And I think versus transactional, for me anyway, I try and build very relational collaboration. So like you say, like, instead of it just being like, oh, what can I do for you? And what do you need from me? It's much more, what can we build together? And how can we make this so that we're helping and supporting each other rather than just, well, edit my document or add some comments. Yeah. Excellent. Thank you for that. Now, I want to shift a little bit away from your journey. Because I think that's very clear and it's really, really inspiring. To talk a little bit more about the research you were doing. So your background is mental health, being a mental health nurse. So how has that experience informed or ended up with the type of research that you're currently doing, advocating for, and supporting in your PhD students?
There are two sort of strands to my work. I think the main strand to my work is, at the moment, building that research capacity.
Okay.
And because if you think of other areas like, you know, cancer research.
Yeah.
And compare that to mental health research, where we still have this paternalistic approach to our patients. You know, when you hear mental.
Oops, whoa, I've lost your sound. I can't hear you. Oh, yeah, you're back.
I don't know what happened.
It's probably just a weird connection thing.
Yeah,
it's fine.
So for me, it was a case of, so I said two strands in my work. Mm-hmm. The first part is that research capacity building amongst underrepresented disciplines in research, which your nurses, your AHPs, your pharmacists. Because I'm really, really passionate about, you know, let's get more evidence, more empirical evidence that would support our mental health care delivery.
Okay. So, continue.
We do have a lot of research in that space. And the question I keep asking is, why are we not translating those evidence into our clinical practice? I'm yet to get an answer, but I'm still probing. And then the other aspect for me is then in terms of my own research, my own area of interest is along the lines of, you know, sort of examining existing, but also examine the sort of the influence of culture. And when I say culture, people tend to think very quickly, you know, ethnicity. That is part of it. But I'm really, really focusing on our systems and processes. How are they informing caregiving? So how is our system, our processes, how are they informing how we deliver care? How are they actually influencing how we deliver care? That is an area of interest to me.
So when you say system, do you mean healthcare system or do you mean societal system?
Everything, really. So it depends on the context I find myself. So within the clinical settings, for example, I support some clinicians to do service evaluations. You know, why do we actually have this? And then lead that to quality improvement if they want to. So for me, it's making sure that we have those clinicians as well that can actually use an empirical piece of work to shape conversations.
Right.
That's the place I find myself. But over in terms of my own work, eventually my portfolio is looking at global mental health as well, looking
okay.
at how, what can we learn from other places. I do some work around adverse childhood experiences in
Sorry, say that
Nigeria.
again.
Adverse childhood experiences.
Okay, adverse childhood. Yep.
Experiences in Nigeria at the moment, for example. So it's interesting to see because a lot of empirical piece of work we have around ACE is very, you know, Western focused. So it's trying to do some work in that space and look at what we can learn as well across the patch. I do some work with the, for example, the Muslim population in terms of access to mental health service. What does mental health actually mean for them in that particular, you know, as a group? Because unless you understand what mental health means to them, if we keep saying there's no access or they're not getting access, then perhaps we're still missing the point, really. And that's where my work really sits at this point in time.
Wow. So that one, that's amazing. And how do you fit that all in? Because I'm just like scratching it down. So you're doing capacity building clinically with lots of different professions and doing everything from like PhD students to clinical service evaluations. And then you're leading an independent program of research that is focused on global mental health. And you've got a project that you're diving into that's based in Nigeria, and then also a specific focused project around a faith-based culture, the Muslim culture, in order to better understand how those two different groups of individuals experience and access mental health care. Wow.
I think that's what comes with the territory of being a clinical academic. And I think it is where I need to be, because I wouldn't, for the experience I had, I wouldn't want to be somewhere talking about something that cannot be translated into clinical practice. And that is just the nature of it. You're right in terms of quite a lot going on there. But the reality is that if we want to have the capacity to do research that is tangible for the population we serve, we need to be able to, you know, be in those places.
Yeah.
And that's why my approach has always been collaborative. So again, this is not just for myself. I work with other people as well. But that's what my area of focus really is, thinking clearly about, you know, our healthcare systems. How are they actually influencing how we provide care? That's the overarching aim. And then you've got these different programs or different projects that can help you tell that story.
That's incredible. I'm so impressed.
Thank you.
No, I think, like, so I've only recently finished, well, it's not that recent anymore, but I like to say it's recent because then I don't feel so guilty about where I am in the world. I finished my PhD in 2022, and I'm working on trying to build a more collaborative and international approach in the research that I do. Because, like you, I agree, like, so much of our research is so focused on a singular perspective, and we'll call a spade, I'm willing to say it, it's white Caucasian males, right? And I think I've seen in my own practice where females or people who don't fit that white male Caucasian perspective, when they clinically present and don't follow that profile, it leaves the healthcare clinicians scratching their head. They start to potentially jump to conclusions about non-adherence, delay care seeking, all of these big terms that are an easy win because it allows them to move on to the next person, because you can be like, well, they're non-adherent. Well, they didn't come for help. You know, it, and I don't think that's an individual decision. I think that's a system-based decision. So I'm not pointing fingers or blaming people for it. But at the same time, and I'm sure you've seen this as well, I see the individuals who don't fit that profile, they suffer. And they suffer more because of not fitting that profile. And so I think, you know, as a fledgling early career researcher, I'm trying really hard to build into my research more inclusivity, to improve the accessibility of research to people regardless of culture, race, any of those personal characteristics, because I want research to be more, and the evidence that we then have to inform our care decisions to be much more inclusive. And everybody's now using these terms of like personalized care and things like that. And I think that's important, but how do you have evidence for personalized care in research, because personalized care requires an N of one, you know, kind of thing. And so what I was wondering is, in your experience, because you're further down the road than me, is what are some top tips that you'd give other researchers about making their research more global, more accessible, more inclusive?
It's interesting you said that further down the line than yourself, which again, that narrative is something I wouldn't accept it, because and I say that because that's where the hierarchy starts. And when we have this hierarchy in research, oftentimes we can miss the point. And what I'm getting at, I can look at your face, is quite, you know, seeing what I'm getting.
No, I'm
getting
fascinated. At. I can't wait to hear what you say.
Because the point here really is that, how do we define this concept? Early career researcher, mid-career researchers, experienced researchers. These are systemic stuff that's been put on us. Bringing that amount of grants, bringing that, my focus, and this is what I strongly believe in, is treat people very well, respect them, and watch the culture shift. When I say that, it's not as easy as, you know, I'm not saying, because I read a particular paper, which was, I think it was Journal of Advanced Nursing, talking about how niceness can be toxic sometimes. So I'm not asking people to be nice here. I'm just asking people to, you know, let's respect what we bring to the team. And that's where the tips, when your question is around what tips do we have here, do I have here? Because if you look at my profile, I'm not the type that I don't have millions of grand to my stuff. I'm very passionate about doing more with less. I'm very passionate about, you know, let people be. If you want to do evaluation, that's great. Go for it. Not everyone is going to have millions of grants, and those things are good. But to me, if I'm being honest, it's secondary. And I think that's what allowed me to be able to make peace with where I am. People say a lot of work is happening. Yes, they are happening because I think it's important. Why are we still struggling with person-centered care in this dispensation? Thinking how long we've been speaking about this in policies. Why are we still struggling from minoritized ethnic communities to get access to mental health support if every policy we've written has these things all over them? My theory is this, that we have a lot of people who are high up there writing policies. Fantastic. We also have our clinicians who are down here who can barely get their heads above the water. Now, we are missing something in the middle, who are the people? What skill set do they need to help the system hardwire these policies? I would argue that if we stop funding research today, are we saying this is the best you can do? I don't have answers, but what I do know is that let us start thinking as a collective. Let us start thinking about how do we collaborate in the real sense of it. And let's for a second forget these titles and hierarchies and all of that for a minute and think about the patient and think about what value are you going to add. I might sound very, very, you know, theoretical, but that is what I strongly believe in. And I see it work. Going back to the tips, I think it's people understanding that, you know, I come with something unique. I'm Oladayo. I have my skill set. You're Roslyn. You have your skill set. Unique individuals. And we need to embrace that. And that is how we can shift a culture. That's how we can move from point A to point B. So the tip I'm getting across there is that, you know, let's value ourselves and let's not put ourselves in this box. I was told at some point, oh, you're ambitious. Start small and then grow big. Of course, I hear that. But given what I see in my clinical practice, I will be selfish to just focus on what I want to do. Because I know that what I want to do as well, I need other people. And the ones I need oftentimes are not the ones that, you know, have those titles where I currently sit. And that's what drives me. And that's what will continue to drive me. Certain things are going to come. It's just a matter of time. But the meantime is sitting still with what I currently have and treating people accordingly, treat them with respect and let them see the value they have, even if, you know, they don't see themselves. And that's where I'm operating at. So that's a tip for me, that value yourself. Do some sort of, you know, do some checks and see what is my strength and go forward with that. Yeah, I don't know if that's enough.
I need you in my life more often. That's more than enough, Oladayo. And like, I couldn't agree more with you. Like, and you're really challenging me, because in my core, I 100% believe what you're saying. And I agree with you that it isn't about the labels. It isn't about how many pounds and grants that you've achieved. You can have very impactful research without any of that. You know, I 100% agree with that. I think, and which that's why I really valued your words, because I think it's very much, well, what you said is recognize your own unique set of skills, your own experience, what you bring to the table, and put value in that rather than value in these arbitrary titles that the system has put on us, and run and just do it. So
yeah, I think it's just staying true to ourselves, because the system wants to sort of manage, which is, we need, don't get me wrong, I respect hierarchy, I respect even those structures. But I've got to be very clear, when a structure wants to force me to go down a path that would make me not to be true to myself.
Yeah.
And the point I'm getting across here as well is that, you know, I think we have a lot of managers around. What we need are leaders. People that will look at the system and help other people to navigate the system based on their privileges.
Yeah.
Not this is how you do stuff.
Yeah.
Times are changing.
Yeah.
And in some fields, in some disciplines, the structure works for that, for them, that is fine. But as far as mental health is concerned, that structure is not going to work We've got to appreciate, you know, the value of service evaluations.
Yeah.
We've got to appreciate the value of quality improvement.
Yeah.
That can then build up to, you know, big research. Coming through to do clinical trials is fantastic, but evidence is telling us that those clinical trials are not recruiting very well when it comes to mental health.
Yeah.
It's no brainer. Let's go back to the basics. But if we want to solve goal with the soft hierarchy, and we would keep investing with little return.
I'm not, I just, wow. Like you're just, wow. You're leaving me speechless, but you're like, I totally agree with what you're saying. And I think, I've come across it quite a lot where, you know, there is all this focus on this other status stuff. And you're right, the patients and their perspectives get lost in that, because if your focus is on how much ref return can I get on an article, are you actually going to be eliciting the opinions of those people who, for millions of reasons, may be very hesitant to sign up to a randomized control trial? And how much value is there in a randomized control trial where the inclusion and exclusion criteria are so limited that it's not representing your population anyway?
Yeah.
That real go. That real passion and real desire to have that real world evidence, not just an evidence based, but real world evidence that matches the populations that we're trying to help, that matches their values, their belief system, that respects where they're coming from and meets them where they are, and then together collaboratively going forward into a solution that is going to mean better health for everybody.
100%, and it takes me back to, you know, the model you have in psychology, where you have the research psychologist assistants, who then go to the deep learning programs.
Yeah.
To me, that's a model that, I'm talking here in the context of mental health nursing. I'm not generalizing across nursing fields. That's a model that can help us support our workforce to see the value of the heart.
Yeah.
We're still far from that at the moment, but that is what that should look like, where people can be on the job and use evidence they collect to shape their clinical practices.
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, you go to uni, you hear what that is saying, you come here, then how do I even acquire that? This particular approach gives you that opportunity to actually problem solve. And early days, but I'm confident that with time, people would see the value that this workforce, nursing at large, the value they have. And I can see as well in the RCM at the moment that, you know, it's becoming very, you know, evidence-based, stiff staffing, patient safety. We've got to acknowledge that this particular workforce, whilst the research skill sets might not be at the level we want it to be, but what we know is that they spend the vast majority of time with those particular patients. How do we help them to be part and parcel, play a role in research delivery?
Yeah, and I think, like, I wish I could remember her name, but I listened to this American emeritus professor talking about nursing and research. And she was saying that a lot of what we as nurses do, we do it without thinking about it because of the amount of time that we spend side by side with patients. And there's a lot that we put down to our gut, our intuition, our yada yada. And she was saying that her belief is that nurses already know how to change care, but we need nurses who can do research across the spectrum that is research. I'm not just saying randomized control trial, like you. It's got to start somewhere. Service evaluation, QI, and like all the various methodologies that are out there, because there's millions of them. It's up to us as nurses to start to step forward, to start to collect that evidence across that spectrum of research, to be able to substantiate the actions that we do. And I was having a conversation with a friend of mine the other day, and we were talking about how, you know, this digital revolution, and like you said, like times are changing and they're changing so quickly. And sometimes it can be really overwhelming to keep up with everything that's happening. But I wonder how much of what we do as nurses with some of these, you know, new techniques, these new methodologies that are coming out, will be actually able to better describe and capture with some of these new techniques, you know. So like we've all been there as nurses. You walk into your patient's room and you've been caring for them for the last couple of days, and you look at them and their pulse is fine, their color is fine, like all of the things that the books tell you are going to tell you that there's something wrong. You can't really see anything, but you're just like, you don't look right. And there's nurses refer that to that as a gut. But I think how much of that is again, is that the easy answer? Because we don't yet know how to capture what our eyes, our noses, our ears, our everything, our senses is telling us about that patient. And because we haven't had the support within our profession to dive into research, we do that. Oh, it's one of my friends, who's a nurse. She's like, I'm a witch, you know, that witchy sense that we get as nurses. We rely on that historical and traditional witch tradition rather than diving into it to be like, what is it that made me go, you're not okay, and I'm going to keep a closer eye on you, and I'm going to do this extra bits and pieces in order to figure out, because you're not right.
It's interesting you say that. Three things what you were talking for me is, for starters, I think it's, I do agree with that empirical professor you mentioned in America, that nurses, we make complex things simple, and that is our strength. But we don't give ourselves the credit for that. And we're not able to give ourselves credit for that, because I would argue that we collect a lot of data. The question is, what are we doing with that data?
Yeah.
And finally, as a mental health nurse, I would say my strength is, you know, how do you manage, how do you nurse the mind? Because you started talking objectively from, you know, take the pulse and all of that stuff. With mental health nursing, my depression will not be your depression.
Yeah.
How do we help the workforce in terms of their reflexivity?
Yeah.
How are you able to take your own ward and look at somebody else's ward and think about, if I was to be in their ward, this wouldn't be easy.
Yeah.
That needs time. That needs time. Yeah. And that's how we need to start thinking about, you know, we talk about safe staffing, we think about all of these patient safety conversations. We need to help the workforce to clearly articulate what the clinical problems really are, and enable them to use the data we currently have to make the right decisions, or, you know, as much as possible in the best interest of our patients. I worry that, you know, this digital revolution will come through and we just want to collect things very quick and quick. That would be a wrong path to take.
Yeah.
We need to have our workforce having the time to actually go through what the data really says.
Yeah.
Because this cognitive bias and unconscious bias, given the speed at which we have information thrown at us these days, is is horrible, I would say. It's horrible because you can't think you know. Sometimes you think you know, but when you actually go back to what the data actually says, we don't know. And sometimes it's a good place to be that we don't know.
Yeah.
Because then you can ask the right people key questions, you know. And to me, that is what research looks like. And that's what I'm committed to. And that is what I take forward in my own practice as well.
I love that. I'm just writing this down because I absolutely loved how you said it. It's a good place to be, not to know. That is, oh, wow. I have just glanced at the time and went an hour. I have thoroughly enjoyed our conversations, Oladayo. Like, thank you so much for being willing to come on, for sharing your journey, your thoughts, and a little taster of some of the research you're doing. Everybody out there listening or watching on YouTube, check out the description because I will list some of his publications that will allow you to dive a bit more into sort of like the different aspects of research that he's doing, and you can get more details and stuff there. Before we go, any last thoughts, opinions, top tips?
I think it would just be sort of a recommendation, if you like, to just tell anyone out there who you're an AHP pharmacist and you have interest in supporting your patients better. The research route is achievable. And it's okay not to know. It's just reaching out to people that see you for who you are. And people that can enable you to do what you think is best by your patient. I think that would just be my also, you know, recommendation. It's not prescriptive, but it's something that has worked for me, and something that I would keep leaning into in terms of that knowledge.
Oh,
thank you for having me.
Oh, no, it's entirely my pleasure. I couldn't have wrapped it up any better. So I'm going to say bye. For now. Thanks to everybody out there who's listening, and I will speak to you soon. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Don't go away. Up next, we have the top three takeaways from this week's podcast by Dr. Rosalyn Austin. This is the first time I actually had a full conversation with Oladayo, and I'd seen him online, I'd been emailing him, and I'd read through his very impressive list of publications and sort of the stuff that he was doing and how he's trying to move not just his career, but build research capacity in nurses and allied health professionals and basically clinicians who aren't medical doctors. And how he talks about things really inspired me. And so I was like, I need to get him on so that I can dive into a little bbit more. And he gratefully agreed and has shared it, not just with me, but with all of you. So my top takeaways from my conversation with Oladayo. First one, the importance of talent spotting. We talked a bit about how in nursing, and it's not unique to nursing, there is a bit of still an existing culture of eating your young, or when more senior people don't necessarily encourage the younger generation of professionals that are coming behind them. Like I said, it's not unique to nursing, but because I think we're both nurses and we're familiar with it, that was our context. But I really liked how he shared how for him, in his journey, those people who were individuals who lift as they climb were really important and really encouraged him, not just to start his career, but to continue in his career and to be the individual that he is and do the work that he's doing. And I think, you know, it can sometimes be discouraging when you are faced with a lot of rejections, or you're being told a lot by that's not possible, it's you're too early in your career, all of those things. And I think it's really important to remember and to hold on to those individuals who are those advocates, who are those supporters of you, who are encouraging you to do the research that you're doing. So I think, yeah, that being half of my top takeaway. So hold on to them, but also become them, pay it forward, be a talent spotter, be a supportive collaborator, so that we build capacity for research across nursing and other healthcare professionals as well. My second top takeaway, which I absolutely loved how he phrased it. There are certain things, how he described things, I was like, whoa, really, really powerful, was don't complain, get a PhD. And as we dived into that a little bit more, you know, it wasn't really about that. What he was trying to say, and we talked about it quite a bit more, was, you know, we're all faced in our professional lives as clinicians with things that don't mesh, that are either we can see, even though it's evidence-based and was what we were taught, it's not meeting that patient's need for whatever reason, or the evidence isn't actually working because of lots of different reasons. And I think, you know, instead of falling into the traps of, oh, it's always the way we've done it, or there's nothing I can do about it, and just complaining, you know, find those people who can help you, whether it's a service evaluation, whether it's quality improvement, whether it is doing a PhD, but to find and surround yourselves with people and networks who can help you make change, so that rather than just sitting back on your heels, you become a proactive individual who's helping to improve our healthcare services, who's helping to improve the experiences of the patients, and then the reason that we often did get into healthcare in the first place. So yeah, don't complain, do a PhD. Right, my third and final takeaway is key to being able to do the breadth of research that he's doing, or maybe other people who've been on the podcast are doing, is collaboration. And we talked about that quite a lot on the podcast, how building individuals who will actually collaborate and enable ideas and to push things forward rather than just adding comments or correcting grammar. And I think, you know, building, it's something I'm really trying to do right now in my career, is to start to build really supportive and collaborative networks around me, and I'd suggest to you out there around your research, people that are going to help challenge, add different perspectives to the work that you want to do, so that together as a group, you're going to balance out each other's weaknesses, shine spotlights on each other's strengths, and that then by having these really supportive networks, your output will then become exponential, because you'll be involved in their work, they'll be involved in your work, and so you'll be able to grow more without necessarily having to hold on to the responsibility of trying to do it all. And I think if I was going to put it into a single phrase, is that's the takeaway, is don't try and do it all, just collaborate. Right. That's it for this week's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you so much to everybody out there who's listening, who's liking, who's resharing, reposting, all of that stuff. You know what to do. It really is, more than anything else, it's encouraging me, but it is helping as well. Like the numbers are growing and things, so it's really exciting to see that. So please keep it up. Like, comment, subscribe. If you have specific questions about this episode, or that you'd like to direct to a guest, as always, drop a comment in the YouTube video, because it's the easiest way for me to find it and to make sure that it gets answered. Other than that, until another 3 weeks, thank you so much for listening, and remember to keep asking why.